headlines. Russia warns Ukraine's neighbors that offering their airfields to Kiev's military aircraft for attacks on Russian forces may be regarded as their involvement in an armed conflict. U.S. gasoline prices jump 11% in a week to hit their highest since 2008 as Western sanctions on Russia over its Ukraine operation reduce Moscow's ability to export oil. Also ahead, Pakistan's premier slams Islamabad-based Western envoys for urging his country to condemn Russia's operation in Ukraine, saying Pakistan is not their slave. That's also in the headlines. Thank you for joining us. And our top story, Russia's President Vladimir Putin says Moscow plans to achieve its objectives in Ukraine either through diplomacy or military means. Putin made the remark during a phone call with his French counterpart. A French official said Putin also demanded the recognition of Crimea as part of Russian territory, as well as the independence of the two Ukrainian breakaway regions recently recognized by Russia. In a separate call, Putin told his Turkish counterpart that Moscow will end the operation once its demands are met and Ukraine stops fighting. On the ground, heavy fighting continues in major Ukrainian cities, including the capital Kiev. The UN chief has called for a pause in the fighting to allow safe passages for civilians. A UN monitor says some 360 civilians have been killed since the conflict began. The Ukrainian president says Russia is now preparing to shell the southern city of Odessa.
They are preparing to bomb Odessa. This is going to be a military crime. This is going to be a historical crime and a war crime.
Zelensky also slammed the West for rejecting his demand to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine or arm it with fighter jets. He said, quote, "You want us to be killed very slowly." In the meantime, Russia warns Ukraine's neighbors, including NATO member Romania, against hosting Kiev's military aircraft, saying they could end up being involved in an armed conflict. This, as a Ukrainian official says, some 20,000 foreign mercenaries have arrived in Ukraine to fight Russians. Denmark has given the green light for its nationals to take up arms in Ukraine. The British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss gave similar permission to UK nationals. However, the head of the UK Armed Forces says it would be unlawful and unhelpful for Britons to go and fight against Russia. So, what does the situation look like on the ground in Ukraine? Here's a map showing Russians' advances and the areas under their control. So, the Russians are pressing inward from the north, east, and south. They are closing in on the capital, Kiev, with a major column of military vehicles stationed outside and aerial bombardments continuing inside. However, the capital is still holding. In the east, Kharkiv, another major city, also remains in Ukrainian hands despite intense bombings. Russian forces are also pressing an offensive through the pro-Russian Donetsk and Luhansk regions. In the northeast, heavy fighting has taken place around and inside the city of Sumy. To the south, Russia has besieged the strategic city of Mariupol, which would link forces pushing north from Crimea to those from the east. Russian troops also appear to be moving on Mykolaiv to the northwest of Kherson, which they seized last week. Joining us for more on that is James Jatteras, former U.S. diplomat and foreign policy analyst from Washington, and also Sarah Flanders, International Action Center from New York. James, if I could start with you, we're hearing from some Western officials that occupied people, referring to Ukraine here, have the absolute right to resist against the occupier. Absolutely, UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss said. I'm just wondering, does that rule also apply to other occupied regions, such as in Palestine or Syria or Iraq?
I don't know if they have a right to do it, but it certainly seems to me a very bad idea that if we look at the way the Russian forces are advancing, they've pretty much shaped the battlefield. They are now have put these cities in a very impossible position to defend. And I think similar to what we saw in Aleppo in Syria, they're going to try to pressure them to for these military forces, both regular military and militias, to leave. I don't think too many actual regular civilians are going to want to get themselves killed in a war that they can't fight. And I think that's why it's really they can't win. That's why it's really unconscionable for these Western governments that are not really going to do much to address the situation in Ukraine directly, nor do I think they should, to encourage them to keep fighting and keep dying for essentially propaganda purposes.
Right. Sarah, just a similar question. Denmark has given the green light for its nationals to take up arms in Ukraine. The British Foreign Secretary, as I mentioned, Liz Truss, gave similar permission to UK nationals. Would they do the same to other regions that are occupied in the world, such as Palestine or Syria or Iraq?
Well, I think they have done the same in their use of hundreds of thousands of mercenary fighters and jihadists and other forces in Syria. We can look back years ago to Afghanistan or look at the Contra forces in Nicaragua. The U.S. has used again and again proxy forces in their wars. At the same time, of course, they object to people's wars. And there's a big difference between resisting and fighting for their own sovereignty and what is happening today when the U.S. is using Ukraine as a way of battering Russia along its 1,200-mile border. The constant use for 8 years of U.S. heavy equipment, U.S. advisors, which are really U.S. troops, but they're, quote, advisors, mercenaries, fascist forces, and Contras. Now they want to escalate that. But they have been doing this for 8 years. And if they wanted this war to end today, it would end today if the U.S. stopped pumping in all of these millions, billions of dollars of lethal arms, U.S. advisors into the Ukraine. So okay. I think we just got to look at how they're using Ukraine in order to fight a war against Russia.
James, would you agree with that? I mean, if you consider the, for example, Zelensky slamming the NATO for their slow action, is saying they want us to die or kill us very slowly. The U.S. is providing aircrafts, but not the aircrafts that Ukrainian pilots are trained to operate. Essentially, is the U.S. interested in ending this or prolonging this conflict?
Oh, clearly, the U.S. is interested in dragging it out and making it as bloody as possible and make sure as many ordinary Ukrainians get killed in the process. This idea of supplying jet fighters is absolutely absurd. I mean, if they do, they better supply them with Japanese pilots because it's going to be a kamikaze mission. They couldn't base them in Ukraine or they'd be destroyed along with the rest of the Ukrainian Air Force that's already been destroyed. And they can't base them in other countries like Poland or Romania because it would make those countries then targets. And the Russians have made it very clear that they would hit them. I think President Putin's comments were not very ambiguous. He said either the Ukrainians, what's left of the Ukrainian government, I'm not even sure how much authority Zelensky has at this point, either they will meet Russia's demands, which are very clear and unconditional, or they will continue with the military operation to its conclusion, which means then they will find somebody else that they put in place that they can make a deal with.
Let's find out the latest social media posts in reaction to the developing events in Eastern Europe. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov notes that Albania, Kosovo, Bosnia and are sending mercenaries to fight in Ukraine. Patrick Claflin says when the US says it's saving Ukraine's democracy, that's BS. It's all about the geopolitical control of the oil and gas, and it sends a message to the European allies not to develop too cozy relationship with Russia, especially the Germans who heavily rely on Russian energy. Boomer says Ukraine, the new Syria, courtesy of the US and its NATO stooges, and what will befall the Ukrainian people? 20 years of mercenary insurgents supplied and armed by the US war industry, butchering men, women and children, for what? Rachel Pirani says, for no reason really, I guess you haven't noticed the Ukrainian regime's barbaric war against their own people for the last 8 years, right on Ukraine, on Russia, that is, its borders, and the millions and billions in weapons and US trainers militarizing Ukraine with guns pointed at Russia. That's an apparent response to the previous post. Sarah, this idea of mercenaries being sent to Ukraine, how is that going to help the situation?
It will help the U.S. inflame the situation further. We can't forget that this same tactic in Syria led to a third of the Syrian population being displaced by war, entire cities in ruin. However, it did not defeat Syria. And now they're using the same tactic in Ukraine to set Ukrainians against each other with a puppet government of their own making, to hammer a part of the country that refused fascist control. But really, they're doing all of this to make a war on Russia, to block the enormous amount of trade that had developed between Russia and the European Union, and the trade from China and Russia into the European Union. The European Union was the largest investor in Russia. The U.S. wants to break all of this, and they're determined to block it. They're determined to block it through the sanctions, and now they're determined to also block it through a war that will lay ruin to all of Ukraine. They have been deeply involved while Ukraine was supposedly neutral and not a NATO member, pumping in these arms for years. But now they're ratcheting it up much higher. And Biden openly announces this, 600 million more of heavy weapons, more U.S. advisors, and now mercenaries who are really the death machine they have no progressive role whatsoever to play. And from all over the world, they're being recruited. Kosovo, that's absolutely true. From Syria, you can bet they have forces in Afghanistan. They have forces that they can pull from all over the world. And anyone who wants the paycheck.
And James, Russian President Vladimir Putin has made demands. And he also says he plans to end the conflict either through diplomacy or military means, as well, in addition to the demands that he has set out. Do you think he's going to get those demands? And do you think the military conflict will be resolved through military or diplomatic means?
If I had to guess, I would say it's probably going to be resolved militarily. I mean, look, we have essentially three wars going on here. We have the military conflict on the ground in Ukraine. We have the propaganda war that's been raging to demonize the Russians. And then we have the financial and economic war. As far as the war in Ukraine goes, yes, the Russians can, and I believe will, win the war on the ground in the very, very near future. The propaganda war, they really can't win. And that's why we see things talk about weapons and some kind of support from the West and mercenaries and so forth, because they want to keep the bleeding and dying going as long as possible, because it's very negative PR for the Russians being hyped by the world media. And then, of course, we have the financial and economic war that, okay, right now, sure, Russia will go through a rough patch, but Russia's above any other country in the world is pretty close to an autarky economically. I mean, look, even the sanctions against Iran, which is not in as strong a position as Russia is, did not work. And I think we're actually going to see a lot more pain in the West, especially in Europe, to some extent in the U.S., but even more in Europe. So this is going to go on for a while. There will be a new Cold War, I believe, for several years, possibly a generation. But what happens on the ground in Ukraine, I think that's going to wrap up relatively quickly. And then the Russians are just going to have to brass it out after that.
Interesting stuff. Let me thank our guests for their time. James Jatteris is a former U.S. diplomat and a foreign policy analyst joining us from Washington, D.C. Also, Sarah Flanders with the International Action Center joining us from New York. Now, moving on, U.S. gasoline prices jumped 11% over the past week, the highest since 2008, as Western sanctions hamper Russia's ability to export crude oil. The national average price for a gallon of regular gas stood at around $4, Authorities say prices are likely to rise further. This as the U.S. Secretary of State has said he held discussions with Europeans about banning Russian oil imports. Antony Blinken, however, stopped short of announcing an outright boycott. Ukraine's foreign minister has asked Western countries to completely stop importing Russian oil. Oil futures contracts have risen to their highest levels since July 2008. The Brent price hit almost $140 a barrel, while the price of the U.S. crude reached $130.50. Meanwhile, Russian banks say they're planning to issue cards using China's Union Pay system after Visa and MasterCard moved to suspend operations in Russia. Pakistan's prime minister has hit out at Islamabad-based Western envoys for their stance on the Russian military operation in Ukraine. Imran Khan says the envoys, who had urged his country to condemn Russia's actions in Ukraine, should not think that Pakistan is their slave. He said the diplomats shouldn't think they can diktat Islamabad. He said Pakistan is not taking sides with any country and will remain neutral. The premier added Islamabad would work with those trying to end the war in Ukraine. Earlier this week, the heads of 22 diplomatic missions, including those of EU member states, released a joint letter calling on Pakistan to support a UN General Assembly resolution condemning Russia's actions against Ukraine. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Like Trump, Boris Johnson has been especially effective in normalizing the scurrilous and norm-shifting aspects of radical right discourse, says Graham McPhee, author, in an article published under the heading Neoliberalism is Normalizing Extreme Right Discourse in the UK. Stay tuned for more. One of the most familiar tactics of populist demagogues when under pressure is to shift the agenda away from reality and into a fantasy world of accusation, smears, false equivalences, and conspiracy theories. This erodes the boundary between the civil and uncivil, resulting in what scholar Ruth Wodak calls the shameless normalization of far-right discourse and ideas. As Wodak explains, the boundaries of the sayable are shifted, and traditional norms and rules of political culture, of negotiation and deliberation are violated by continuous provocations. Hoping to change the media conversation after a damning report on COVID rule-breaking within his administration, Conservative Prime Minister Boris Johnson swiftly deployed this tactic by smearing his chief parliamentary accuser, Labour Party leader Keir Starmer. The slur centres on the baseless and discredited claim that Starmer had protected from prosecution one of Britain's most notorious pedophile predators, this great celebrity Jimmy Savile. This untruth has its origins in the murky world of far-right conspiracy theory, and its endorsement by the Prime Minister has emboldened extremists. Most damning of all has been the condemnation by Savile's victims, relayed by lawyer Richard Scorer, who represented many of them. I can confirm that these allegations against Sir Keir Starmer are completely unfounded and unjustified, Scorer states unequivocally, adding that weaponizing the victim's suffering to get out of a political hole is disgraceful. Johnson's attempt to defend the false allegations suggests a level of a strategic purpose and political calculation, although he may have miscalculated this time. Polling remains dire, while support for Johnson among conservative legislators is ebbing as key aides resign. The jury is still out, and international events may yet give Johnson a reprieve. But if his premiership eventually crashes and burns, there is a danger that the problems this scandal reveals are personalized and localized. The contemptible nature of the smear and the Johnson's attention-grabbing personality encourage the tendency to see the rot only in this particularly bad apple, and the danger to democracy only in a certain style of political pantomime and a scurrilous discourse. Longer-term tendencies, social and institutional structures, and the cohorts of forerunners, allies, and enablers thereby go unnoticed. Recent political experience in the United States can be illuminating here. To an even greater extent, the oxygen-sucking presence of Donald Trump has focused attention on a single figure as the crux upon which the threat to U.S. democracy depends. But as a number of scholars have noted, the trends leading up to the present are deep-seated and still operative. And the coalitions invested in anti-democratic outcomes are more widespread than any single current or personality. In short, the anti-democratic slate is as much a function of the normal way things have been ticking over for decades as it is of moments of crisis, emergency, or the exceptional. In Britain, while Brexit certainly supercharged an antagonistic nativist politics that normalizes extreme right ideas, this tendency did not begin there. Xenophobic and authoritarian ideas that draw on and feed into the worldview of the radical right have been driving key government initiatives for decades. In 2012, the Conservative Liberal Democrat Coalition launched its hostile environment policy, a dizzying array of measures explicitly designed to make life so unbearable for undocumented migrants that they would voluntarily choose to leave. These policies culminated in the Windrush scandal, whereby an estimated 15,000 British citizens of Caribbean descent were wrongly classified as illegal immigrants, with devastating consequences. Families were separated, people lost their jobs and homes, and many were detained and threatened with being deported to countries they barely knew. The message being sent appears quite clear. Britain's problems are the result of alien invaders, and those invaders are most likely non-white. And in 2003, the then Labour government launched the Prevent a Strategy, a post-9/11 initiative ostensibly aimed at preempting radicalization and preventing homegrown terrorism. Widely perceived as targeting British Muslims as a suspect community, the program has been criticized not only as counterproductive, but also for creating the potential for systematic human rights abuses and an increased risk of discrimination. And there is much more of a similar vein in the pipeline. Legislation currently going through Parliament includes a new borders and nationality bill that breaches international law and which arguably creates a second-class, precarious version of citizenship for those with ties to other countries and unable to claim exclusively British descent. An elections bill on the GDP model imposes new and unnecessary obstacles to voting, which in the judgment of one of the governing party's own members of Parliament risks undermining one of the most fundamental rights we have here in the UK to vote freely without restriction. Meanwhile, the new policing and crime bill threatens to significantly erode the right to freedom of assembly and peaceful protest. In each case, the legislation is designed to pick apart the paradigm of universal democratic citizenship, which is meant to be open to all citizens regardless of race, ethnicity, social class, or political affiliation. Instead, they privilege a national population, the supposedly real English people, as opposed to ethnic outsiders and the cultural elites who are said to despise the nation. And it is this long-term build-up of a populist, common-sense nativism that represents the most fundamental mainstreaming of extreme-right norms and values. The dynamics driving this longer-term trend are complex, but a clue lies in the fact that its proponents include all the parties involved in government since the turn of the millennium. Labour and Liberal Democrat, as well as Conservative, for example, the origins of the hostile environment policy lie in the anti-immigrant crackdown under the new Labour administration in 2007. This speaks to the larger political shifts associated with the cementing of the neoliberal consensus since 1980s in Britain and globally. Neoliberalism, the ideology of privatization, financialization, and labor precarity, not only generates record levels of income and wealth inequality, but also leaves an ideological vacuum by jettisoning the element of redistribution once central to social democratic policies. As political philosopher Nancy Fraser has argued, the easiest way to compensate for this absence is to stress the elements of recognition in politics those culturally defined makers of esteem, status, and identity. And because extreme right ideas focus on the identity of majority of demographics through populist nationalism and resentment at perceived cultural disesteem, neoliberal politics finds a particular affinity there. According to Fraser, this affinity has been particularly strengthened in the UK and the US because under Tony Blair's New Labour and Bill Clinton's New Democrats, neoliberal economics was initially associated with a progressive model of recognition. The discourses of multiculturalism and gender equality that are now pilloried as politically correct or woke. Successful at the time, the center-left has bequeathed a legacy that for many seems to combine the worst of both worlds. While presiding over the collapse of secure employment, these administrations were perceived as sneering at the cultural norms and traditional values of the working class and the blue-collar middle class. For this reason, although governments of every stripe have implemented neoliberalism, it is the center-left that is perceived to have sided with the elites and betrayed ordinary people. After 9/11, New Labour in the UK jettisoned its commitment to multiculturalism and cultural cosmopolitanism, adopting a nativist rhetoric that even the Conservatives denounced as borrowing from the extreme right. But without a different model of economic distribution, a real shift away from neoliberalism, and a return to a revived social democracy, all that has been achieved is an even deeper normalization of extreme right discourse. And it is this tendency that subsequent conservative-led governments have pursued with relish. Like Trump, Boris Johnson has been especially effective in normalizing the scurrilous and norm-shifting aspects of radical right discourse. But the deeper threats to UK democracy, just as in the United States, will still need to be addressed once these divisive figures are gone.
Food for thought.
Salam, everybody, and heartiest felicitations to you all. Today, on the auspicious birthday of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, the younger grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, let us listen to a gem of a saying from the immortal martyr of Karbala. By my life, what is the Imam except the one who judges by the book, who upholds justice, who professes the religion of truth, and who devotes himself to the will of Allah?
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer doubts and misconceptions from around the world on Islamic issues and Islamic principles. Like always, in our recent shows, we have invited Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary Schools. We'd like to welcome him to this show and say salam to him and inshallah start our discussion with him. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. It's a great pleasure for us. The question of the day that we want to talk about it in this very session and ask our respected guest speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, to shed some light on that and inform us about the different aspects of it, is about astrology and the prediction of the future by the knowledge of the stars and through the knowledge that some people have from stars and also celestial bodies. It is it's common among some people that they believe in such things. We want to know if we also are allowed to refer to such people and to take some information from them, because we are also in need of some critical information for our future. I want to know, for example, what to do exactly and what comes to me and what happens to me in my upcoming days and upcoming weeks. So it's very nice and even interesting to know that there is a knowledge. Some people have a sort of knowledge that they can predict future, and they can look at the star and tell you which one is your own star, and then they will guide you what to do and what will come to you and what will come to you and what will happen to you. So let's ask the basic question: that what's the Islamic perspective on the astrology and this sort of prediction, Sheikhna? I should be thankful if you shed some light on that and tell us what is Islamic perspective and such knowledge, and that some people are equipped with, that they know that about your future, and they look at you and they guess which one is your own star, and then they will predict whatever you need. So tell us more about that.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think that we should look at the moments, because because what matters is the moment that you leave. I want to say that we should look at our responsibility and what is a best choice that we want to do right now. Mm-hmm. Because the past has been past and the future, of course, did not come yet. Mm-hmm. What matters is right now, and I want to, you know, have the best choice and the best action right now. Mm-hmm. But when you want to have any kind of, you know, prediction for the future, there have been some people that refer to the, as you mentioned, to the, for example, astrology or celestial bodies, whether these kind of, you know, ideas are acceptable or not.
Yeah.
You see that when... if you believe that this kind of celestial body has some kind of effect on the life of human being, and you want to refute the power and the decisions of Allah and the maintenance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if you refute that, for sure it is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And it is not acceptable to believe that, I want to say that rationally speaking, it is not acceptable to believe that any kind of celestial body, they have some effect on your life.
Yeah.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is maintainer of the universe.
Yeah.
He created this universe and he has all power for, you know, controlling and giving sustenance to the universe and to the human being. It is not acceptable to say that any kind of celestial body or astrology have any kind of effect on the life of the human being. And of course, you cannot do it in a certain way. You cannot say that for sure these celestial bodies, they have some effect on the life of the human being. Maybe some people, they can claim that by some possibilities, okay? Because something is possible or not. But you cannot tell it and express it in certain way. But after all, of the point that I want to make here, and it is a most important thing, that these celestial bodies, they cannot refute the power and the maintenance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is all powerful and all knowing, and he has all control over the, you know, human being and over the universe, because he is Rabbul Alameen. He has created and the all worlds, and he is a, you know, we can say the owner of the these two. He is a owner of all worlds.
Sheikh, what is interesting is that those who claim to have such knowledge, they say that they have gained this knowledge by Allah's power, that they are actually acting upon what Allah has gifted them. So he says that, he or she says that, Allah has gifted me a sort of knowledge that I know what comes to your future. The question is, why Allah himself did not give us this knowledge to know about our future? I mean, directly to ourselves. So Allah gifts it to some certain people. Then is it, again, okay to talk about future events that comes to a person, I mean, while others have no idea of it? So, but again, in a hadith, we have that أَبَلَّا أَنْ يَجَلْ أُمْرِ اللَّهِ بِأَسْبَابَهَا. Allah wants everything to be in its own natural way to happen. So why, how can we actually solve these issues? And if we put different, let's say, parts of this puzzle together, how can we make it a full puzzle?
You see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has two proof. إِنَّ لِلَّهِ عَلَى النَّاسِ هُجَّتَيْنِ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, according to the narrations of Imam al-Qadim alayhi salatu wa salam to Hisham, he said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has two proof. First of all, your reasoning, the power of reasoning. Second, al-anbiya wal-rusul wal-awsiya, prophets and the successor of the prophets. You see that these are play the role of a proof for the human being. You see that many people, they claim many things. They claim that Allah give me this power, I can protect, your future, I have the power of all things. You know, these are not acceptable, rationally speaking. These are not acceptable. You should have some proof, you should bring some proof for your claims. If not, your proof is refuted.
Okay? Very true.
This is a first answer to the question.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Why Allah hasn't gifted this power, this knowledge to everyone and gave it to some certain people?
Because it has some harm for the normal life of the human being.
Okay.
You see that? Because if, for example, I know that...
So how come it has this harm and, let's say, this badness for some people and it is good for some?
Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to, you know, keep the normal life of the human being. It is not necessary to know your future. Because if an individual, he knows or she knows that, for example, after a month, that person going to die, he or she lose the normal life of his daily life.
So it is not Allah's custom and habit, or less a sunnah, to inform a person from what comes to him in his future.
Exactly.
Except the awliya of Allah, the highest people in rank and purity, might know that, but they will act like, because they are the materialization of names and attributes of Allah, then they are silent like Allah is.
Of course, even talking about the prophets and awliya, the successor of the prophets, they know they have ilmul ladunni, is kind of God-given knowledge.
True.
But they did not use it in all occasions.
So, all those, so we can make a conclusion, all those who use them in different occasions, they have no knowledge of it.
Of course, yes, exactly. Those people, for example, I want to refute this idea that those people who claim that we know the future, I have God-given knowledge or so on and so forth, these are not acceptable.
Yeah.
And these are kind of, you know, mere claims.
Very true.
False claims that has no proof supporting that.
Very true.
For example, if you look at the verses of Noble Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that وَلَا تَقُولَنَّ لِشَيْءٍ إِنِّي فَائِلٌ دَالِكَ قَدًا إِلَّا أَنْ يَشَاءَ اللَّهِ. Do not say for sure I'm going to do that tomorrow, except that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants it. Okay. In this verse of Noble Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to encourage us to always have kind of reliance or tawakkul to Almighty, not forget the power and the might of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and to always have this kind of reliance to Him. And actually, this is a meaning of the tawakkul or reliance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, we have Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakil. Allah is sufficient for us and He is a best supporter, you know. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to always remember Him and to have kind of connection to Him. But these people who claim to know the future of the human being, because if you have these ideas, first of all, they are false claims. Mm-hmm. Nobody have kind bring any kind of acceptable proof whether you have this ability or not, mm-hmm. because they are proofless and they do not have any proof for that.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, it defeats the idea of tawakkul and reliance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And after that, it's ruined your normal life.
Very true.
Okay? Yeah. If you granted that you know you have this ability.
Yeah.
Of course, we have all doubt about that. But granted, you have this ability, it's, you know, ruined your normal life.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh. That's true. So we need to pay close attention to this concept that anyone who believes, anyone who claims to have a sort of knowledge of astrology and prediction of the future, so we need to actually look at such issues and such claimers with more care. And we need just to rely and depend on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has written for us and has actually, whatever He has destined for us. So those who have the knowledge of ilm al-laduni, or they have a sort of, let's say, divine knowledge, they're connected to Allah. And they are not the ones who come to you and tell you, for example, what has been written for you in your stars and your, let's say, in future we will face such and such. So those who have this knowledge are not the ones who come to claim it in public.
Let me add one point here about the tawakkul or trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah.
Tawakkul means to Allah takhafa ma Allah ahada. To always remember Him and to not to be fearful of anything or anybody while you're remembering Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So
very
it means
true.
That you should do your best, you should plan, you should have the best decision,
mm-hmm.
but after all, rely on Allah for having the best fruit for that.
Jazakallah khair. Very beautiful, Sheikh. Thank you very much. Dear listeners, thank you for your staying tuned and listening to us from IRB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Cultural News Social News Scientific News Artistic News With the Light
The 2022 World Cup is reaching a fever pitch as hundreds of people line up at a shopping center in Qatar to take a picture with a trophy. The famous Golden World Cup trophy was unveiled during a ceremony at a mall in Doha, where excited football fans waited for their turn to see it. They were also given the option to take a selfie or have their photo taken professionally. While the competition is still nearly a year away, FIFA says more than a million tickets were requested within the first 24 hours after sales opened. The highest demand came from fans from Qatar, followed by Argentina, Mexico, and the United States, among others. Bangladesh is reviving the ancient tradition of producing a historically renowned fine hand-woven fabric called muslin. With the help of the government, the trade is making a comeback. Now, a workshop has been set up in Dhaka where weavers are being trained in the ancient art. They say it took them months to master the craft, working with incredibly fine hand-spun cotton yarns. The weavers say it takes them 8 hours to spin just 4 centimeters. Some varieties of the fabric are so fine that an entire muslin sari could fit inside a single matchbox.
There was a myth about muslin, that it was so delicate that it would pass through even a small ring. Look, it's true. There is space to squeeze in another piece of cloth through this ring as well.
Breathing life back into this ancient trade was not easy. Officials with a revival project say there was little knowledge about how this fabric was made. Plus, the rare cotton variant, which makes this fabric so expensive, was also lost. The precious fabric was the most extravagant of its era and popular in Mughal courts. It was also imported into Europe for much of the 17th century and transformed the style of the aristocracy there.
An art gallery in London, Tate Modern, is hosting an exhibition with a remarkable span of surrealist works. The exhibition, dubbed Surrealism Beyond Borders, features more than 170 artworks ranging from paintings and sculptures to photography and films. Works by more than 150 artists from over 60 years are on the display. The exhibit also has a wide geographical span and includes surrealist artworks from different countries. Some of the most prominent artists whose works are being exhibited include Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and Ted Jones. The exhibition will run until August 9th. Impressive, creative, wonderful. That's how visitors describe the works of Vincent Hoch, a Dutch post-impressionist painter being displayed in an impressive art exhibition in the Argentine capital. Hundreds of Van Hoch's paintings are projected onto the walls of the gallery. The image bloom and ripple in front of the audience, creating a 3D-like and immersive experience. Van Gogh was one of the most famous and influential figures in Western art history of the 19th century. He is largely remembered for his impressionist style, a break from the old traditional art technique. He is also famous for his turbulent life, which was made for outlandish, emotionally charged paintings.
Persian language takes center stage in a conference in Tehran dubbed Promotion of Persian Language on Global Scale. The event seeks to preserve the ancient language through teaching it to non-Iranians. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Iran Imruz.
Persian language has been spoken for 3 millennia, but like every cultural heritage, it needs to be preserved. This is according to officials from Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who sat with Persian language activists to discuss ways to promote Persian through teaching it to non-Iranians.
Today is actually the Persian language day for me and for many of my colleagues. So if you allow me, I would like to continue in Farsi.
Thank you for this opportunity.
The identity of a nation is a set of shared beliefs, shared culture and history, and all of these issues are reflected in the language that each nation speaks. So today, all of those who have a role in the promotion of Persian language gathered to exchange views on the preservation of Persian, and we at the Foreign Ministry will facilitate any effort made in this regard.
A thousand years ago, Iran had a poet named Ferdowsi whose poems are still popular and understood by our generation. This is significant and shows that Persian is an old language that has stayed intact through the centuries.
Sa'di Foundation is the leading entity in the promotion of Persian language. Every year, the Institute, together with the Islamic Culture and Relations Organization, holds a number of Persian refresher courses in and outside Iran for non-Persian speakers. Recently, the Institute has launched online courses and published self-study books for Persian language enthusiasts.
By launching the online Persian training platforms, we saw a sudden increase in the number of applicants from different countries. This is because many of those who are interested in learning Persian gained an instant access to Persian teaching contents. At the same time, we continue to launch in-person courses organized by Iran's cultural attaches and hosted by Iranian overseas schools.
Persian comes from the Indo-European family of languages. The earliest versions of Persian date back to roughly 2,500 years ago, during the Achaemenid dynasty. Today, it is spoken by more than 300 million people in the world, and different dialects, including Dari and Pashto, in countries such as Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. Besides its significant impact on science, medicine, and astronomy, Persian has its own prominent place in literature and poetry. Khayyam, Rumi, Sa'di, and Hafez are only a few examples of world-renowned Persian poets. Language is the identity of a nation, and through the centuries of its spoken and written history, Persian has grown to become the narrator of Iran's rich past and its ancient civilization. Now, as learning a language is learning a culture, experts here say promoting Persian on a global scale is translated into introducing Iran and its culture to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
It is now well-established fact that animals feel, think, behave, and even experience pain. Thus, they should be treated with the same respect as humans, while a center in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo is doing the same. Life-saving services to injured apes. The sanctuary, located in a vast national park, has been active for two decades. The center houses scores of chimpanzees, gorillas, and endangered great apes. Bonobos and bombos as well. Most of the animals that are brought to the sanctuary were rescued from poachers. The staff there provide medical care to the injured animals until they are healthy enough to be integrated into a group of their fellow species.
Students and staff gather for sizzling meat sandwiches as they signal their orders with their hands at a food truck in Pakistan's capital city of Islamabad. The Abbey Cow is no ordinary food truck parked on the campus of the Millennium Universal College. It's fully managed and run by staff with hearing impairments. At the beginning of the queue, a diagram shows simple phrases in sign language which customers use to order their food and communicate. The food truck is Pakistan's first mobile restaurant entirely staffed by deaf workers, providing an economic opportunity for them.
Having the startup here at our campus has been really fruitful. Not only have we created more awareness around the sign language amongst our students, but we've also created an inspiration for TMUC students to look up and pursue entrepreneurship as a career choice.
The project developer, Aisha Raza, says the majority of deaf youth end up unemployed and face inequality and discrimination. She says she wanted to create an opportunity for her brothers to economically thrive. The goal is to bridge communication gaps between the deaf and hearing communities and help remove language barriers. The food truck is the brainchild of a family where both parents and their sons are either totally or partially deaf.